take her.
The ruthless Duke thought he'd pick an ugly duckling at the marriage auction, but is shocked to unveil her true beauty. The marriage assembly was where families brought the women they had given up on, and as Sarah Henderson stood in that candlelit hall, dressed in a rough, drab gown with a coarse sack hood tied over her face, she knew exactly what she was to her stepmother. Not a daughter, not even a person, a problem to be sold. Her wrists were bound with rope, her face was completely hidden, and every person in that hall was whispering the same question: what could be so wrong with a woman that her own family would bring her here looking like this? Then the doors opened. Duke Jasper Knowles walked in, and the entire room went silent. He was the most powerful, most feared man in England. He could have chosen any woman there, beautiful women, wealthy women, women whose families were practically begging him to look their way. He walked past every single one of them. He stopped in front of Sarah. He looked at the rope on her wrists, the sack over her face, and said four words that shook the entire hall: "I will take her." What he did not know what would change everything was what was hiding beneath that hood. Stay with us, because this story is just getting started. Welcome to Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles. If you're ready for more stories where the unexpected happens, where the forgotten rise, and where the underdogs turn the game around, hit that subscribe button right now. You don't want to miss what's coming next. Drop a comment below. Let me know where you're watching from and what's on your mind. Don't forget to like, share, and hit that notification bell so you never miss a moment of the drama, the revenge, and the secrets waiting to be uncovered. Welcome to the family. Now let's dive in. The marriage assembly of Whitmore Hall was not the kind of place that announced itself with honesty. From the outside, it looked like any other gathering of England's respectable classes: candlelight spilling warm and golden through tall windows, carriages lined along the cobblestones, the distant sound of a string quartet drifting out into the cold evening air. It looked, to anyone passing by, like a celebration. It was not a celebration. Inside, beneath the chandeliers and the powdered wigs and the careful smiles, it was something far closer to a market. The women stood in loosely arranged rows near the far end of the hall, each one presented by her family like merchandise arranged on a shelf. Mothers hovered at their daughters' elbows, whispering last-minute instructions. Fathers stood at slight distances, pretending to be engaged in conversation while their eyes tracked every man of means who entered the room. The daughters themselves held their chins at precisely calculated angles, high enough to suggest confidence, low enough not to appear threatening. Every gown had been chosen with strategy. Every curl had been placed with intention. Every smile had been rehearsed until it no longer reached the eyes. Sarah Henderson stood at the very end of the row, and she had not been dressed with strategy. She had been dressed with contempt. The gown Viscountess Maren had selected for her was the color of old mud, a thick, shapeless wool that hung from Sarah's shoulders, as though it had been made for a woman twice her size and half her height. Her hair, which in any other circumstance might have caught the candlelight in warm waves of auburn gold, had been scraped back from her face so severely that it pulled at the corners of her eyes. Over all of it sat the hood, coarse, rough-textured, tied beneath her chin in a knot that was clearly meant to be difficult to remove quickly. It covered not just her hair but the upper portion of her face entirely, leaving visible only the lower half: a jaw, a mouth held in careful stillness, a throat that rose and fell with steady, deliberate breaths. She did not look like a woman being presented for marriage. She looked like a woman being delivered somewhere against her will, which, when Sarah considered it honestly, was not entirely inaccurate. Viscountess Maren stood 3 feet to her left, dressed in deep burgundy silk, her own powdered hair elaborately pinned. She had not spoken to Sarah since they arrived. She had barely spoken to her in the carriage. The arrangement was understood between them without words. Maren was here to collect a settlement fee, and Sarah was here to make that possible. The faster it was done, the better for everyone. The worse the offer, the less Maren cared. A coal merchant, a widowed landowner with debts, a second son with a temper, any of these would do. Sarah simply needed to be gone. Around her, The other women drew glances and comments. There was a young woman in pale blue, with roses sewn along her neckline, who made three different gentlemen find reasons to linger nearby. There was a widow in silver gray who carried herself with the kind of tired dignity that some men found appealing. There were daughters with impressive dowries whose fathers had helpfully ensured the numbers were murmured into the right ears before the evening began. And then there was Sarah, who drew whispers of an entirely different kind. What is wrong with that one? The question moved through the room like a slow current. People were too well-bred to stare directly, so they stared sideways instead, quick, cutting glances at the hooded figure at the end of the row. The hood alone was unusual enough. The rope marks, still faintly visible at her wrists from the journey, were something else entirely. Marin had not bothered to have them properly covered. Sarah heard everything. She kept her gaze on the middle distance and said nothing. She was not embarrassed, exactly. Embarrassment required a belief that one deserved better, and Sarah had spent enough years in Viscountess Marin's house to have that belief worn very thin. What she felt, standing there in the candlelight with half of England's minor nobility examining her like a curiosity, was something quieter and more resigned. She was waiting for it to be over. She was waiting to find out what form her future would take, and she was already preparing herself for the likelihood that it would not be kind. What she had not prepared for was the doors opening the way they did. There was no announcement. There was no herald. The doors simply opened, and the room changed. It was difficult to explain, afterwards, to anyone who had not been there. The music did not stop immediately. The conversations did not fall silent all at once. It happened gradually, like a candle being slowly covered one voice at a time, one instrument at a time, until the entire hall had gone quiet and every face had turned toward the entrance. Duke Jasper Knowles of Ashford stood in the doorway. He was tall in a way that the doorframe seemed barely adequate for broad across the shoulders, dressed in a black military coat so heavily decorated with gold braiding and dark embroidery that it seemed to absorb the candlelight around him rather than reflect it. A fur-trimmed cape sat over one shoulder. His gloves were black leather. His jaw was set with the particular kind of stillness that belonged to men who had never once needed to raise their voices to be obeyed. His hair was dark, pulled back at the neck, and his face, the face that had allegedly caused at least two young women of good family to write extremely poor poetry, was severe, in a way that went beyond handsomeness into something more unsettling. It was not cruel, exactly. It was simply without softness, without any visible interest in the opinion of anyone present. He looked at the room the way a man looked at a problem he had already decided how to solve. Every mother in Whitmore Hall straightened. Every daughter who had been rehearsing her smile deployed it immediately. Three different fathers began moving toward the entrance with the barely concealed urgency of men who had waited years for precisely this moment. Jasper Knowles did not look at any of them. He walked into the hall at a measured pace, and the crowd parted for him the way water parted for something cold and moving fast. His gaze swept the room without expression, passing over the women in their careful gowns, the hopeful mothers, the posturing fathers, the roses and the ringlets and the calculated smiles. He moved down the length of the hall with the unhurried certainty of a man who had already made his decision before he arrived and was simply here to execute it. He reached the end of the row. He stopped in front of Sarah. The silence in that moment was a living thing. Sarah felt it press against her from every direction. She had not moved. She had not looked up. She was aware of him, the way one was aware of a change in weather, not seen, exactly, but felt. A shift in the temperature and pressure of everything around her. She heard his boots on the floor. She felt the pause, then his voice, low and even and carrying absolutely no uncertainty at all. "I will take this one." The hall did not erupt immediately. For two full seconds, there was only silence, as if the room collectively needed that time to process what it had just heard. Then the murmuring began, low and disbelieving, and then louder, and then Viscountess Marin made a sound beside Sarah that was half gasp and half something dangerously close to triumph. Sarah did not move. She was not sure her legs would carry her if she tried. The Duke of Ashford had looked at every woman in this room. he had passed a young woman in roses who had made three men linger. He had walked past the widow in silver gray, past the daughters with their carefully circulated dowry numbers, past every carefully constructed presentation of femininity and worth on offer tonight. And he had chosen the one in the burlap hood. She could not understand it. She did not try to. She simply stood very still, while Viscountess Maron began moving and talking and smiling in the direction of the Duke's solicitor, and she told herself what she had been telling herself for years. Survive first. Understand later. The private parlor they were shown to was small by Whitmore Hall standards. A fire, two chairs, a writing table, and a window that looked out onto nothing but darkness. A solicitor sat at the table with a leather case. Viscountess Maron had been asked to wait outside, which she had not enjoyed, but which she had not dared refuse. Sarah sat across from Jasper Knowles for the first time, without the buffer of a crowded room between them. He was, if anything, more severe at close distance. The embroidery on his coat was extraordinarily fine. She could see that now gold thread worked into patterns that must have taken someone months. His gloves were still on. He sat with the particular stillness of a man who had made himself very difficult to read over a very long time, and was not about to stop now. Through the rough fabric of her hood, Sarah studied what she could see of him and waited. He spoke first, and he did not waste words on pleasantries. His terms were these. He required a wife to manage Ashford Manor and, in time, to provide an heir. He had no interest in companionship, in affection, in any arrangement that resembled an actual marriage beyond its legal function. He would not involve himself in her daily life. He would not make demands on her time or her person beyond what was necessary. He would not ask her to love him. He would not insult her by pretending to love her. It was a contract. It would be honored on both sides, and that was all it needed to be. He said all of this in the same tone a man might use to dictate a letter about crop yields. Sarah listened to every word. She had expected a great many things from this evening indifference, yes, but also the particular kind of casual cruelty that wealthy men sometimes practiced on women who had no recourse. She had expected conditions that would humiliate. She had expected to leave this room feeling smaller than she had entered it. She had not expected honesty. There was something almost restful about a man who simply said what he meant. Maron had never once said what she meant. Every instruction in that house had been wrapped in layers of implication and plausible deniability. Every cruelty had been delivered with a smile. Jasper Knowles looked at her hood and said nothing about it, did not ask, did not demand she remove it, simply continued to the next point on his list as though a woman with a covered face were an entirely unremarkable thing. Sarah heard herself agree. The solicitor prepared the documents. The terms were fair. More than fair, a household allowance, a set of rooms, staff, access to the estate's accounts for the purpose of running it efficiently. She would be a duchess in name and function, if not in feeling. It was more than she had been given in years. Viscountess Maron was brought in to sign as Sarah's guardian. She signed quickly, her eyes on the settlement figure at the bottom of the page, rather than on Sarah's face. The solicitor handed her an envelope. She put it directly into the small bag at her wrist without looking up. She did not say goodbye. She said something to Jasper's solicitor about the pleasure of the arrangement, something about hoping the match would prove satisfactory, something that sounded like the closing pleasantries of a business transaction, which was, Sarah supposed, exactly what it was. Then she left. Sarah watched the door close behind the woman who had raised her, if raising was the right word for what Maron had done. And she felt nothing. That, in itself, was a kind of answer. The carriage that carried them toward Ashford was dark inside, and moved at a steady pace through country roads that Sarah could not see. Jasper sat across from her in the opposite seat, one gloved hand resting on his knee, his gaze directed at the window beside him. He did not speak. He did not look at her. He did not make any gesture toward the hood she still wore. Did not indicate by any flicker of expression that he found the situation strange. Miles passed. The fire warmth of Whitmore Hall faded into the cold of a late English evening. Sarah sat in the darkness and breathed, and let herself, very carefully, consider the possibility that cold indifference might be survivable in a way that active cruelty was not. Ashford Manor arrived before dawn, and even in the gray pre-light it was enormous. Stone towers, long windows, a drive that went on longer than seemed reasonable. It was the kind of house that had not been built for comfort but for statement, and the statement it made was one of absolute, unapologetic power. The gardens that flanked the approach had the look of things that had once been magnificent and had been allowed, slowly, to become less so. Overgrown hedges, paths where the gravel had gone thin, rose bushes that had grown past their stakes and were now simply growing however they chose. Inside, the staff was assembled in the entrance hall, a double line of faces ranging from carefully neutral to openly curious. Jasper introduced no one, he said, to the assembled household, that this was the new Duchess of Ashford, and that she was to be given every courtesy and cooperation, and then he walked toward his study and was gone before anyone had fully absorbed the instruction. Sarah stood in the entrance hall in her drab gown and her rough hood, and felt 40 pairs of eyes on her and lifted her chin. The housekeeper stepped forward first. Her name was Mrs. Wolfe, a woman of middle years with gray threading through dark hair and an expression that was neither warm nor unwelcoming. It was the expression of someone who was withholding judgment. She showed Sarah to her rooms, explained the household schedule, and answered every question Sarah asked with complete efficiency. She did not volunteer information. She did not smile. But she was not unkind, and Sarah, who had learned to measure kindness in very small units, noted this. The rooms were large and cold and smelled faintly of disuse, as though they had been waiting for someone and had stopped expecting anyone to arrive. The estate steward was a man named Thorne, angular, watchful, with eyes that moved over Sarah from her hood to her worn shoes and back again with an assessment that was not kind at all. When she asked about the household accounts on her second morning, he told her they were managed satisfactorily, thank you, and that the Duchess need not concern herself. The words were polite. The tone was a door being closed. Sarah asked again 3 days later, and the day after that, until Thorne understood that the new Duchess of Ashford was not going away. Dottie arrived on her third day, a young woman with a round face and quick, observant eyes who had been assigned as Sarah's personal maid. She was perhaps 19, and she had the gift of comfortable silence. She did not fill every moment with chatter, but she was present, and her presence had a particular quality that Sarah had not felt in a very long time. She felt, sitting in the chair by the window while Dottie arranged her things, something close to safe. The manor revealed itself in pieces as Sarah moved through it. The library was extraordinary, shelf upon shelf from floor to ceiling, a rolling ladder on a brass rail, a fireplace that heated the room to genuine warmth, even on cold mornings. She spent hours there and saw no one. The east wing had been closed off, doors shut, rooms sheeted, a particular quality of stillness that felt less like unused space and more like avoided space. She asked Dottie, once, about the east wing. Dottie's expression shifted in a small, careful way. The previous Duchess had preferred those rooms, she said. And then she found something to do with her hands and said nothing more. The previous Duchess. Beautiful, Dottie had said, when Sarah pressed gently on another day. Very beautiful. The whole county had said so. Everyone had said so. She had come from a very good family, and she had been very admired, and then she had been gone. And the manor had been the way it was. Now for 2 years, the east wing closed, the gardens untended, the Duke in his study. Sarah listened to all of this, and asked no further questions. But she looked at the untended gardens through the window, and she thought about what it meant for a man to stop tending things. It was 11 days into the marriage when she went to the library at 12:30 and found it already occupied. She had not been able to sleep. She had taken to walking the corridors in the small hours when the house was quiet, finding it easier to think when there was no one to perform composure for. The library had become her destination by habit. The warmth of it, the smell of old paper and leather, the way the firelight made the whole room feel like it existed slightly apart from everything else. She pushed open the door and stopped. Jasper Knowles was sitting in the chair by the fire with a book open across his knee. He was not reading it. He was looking at the fire with the expression of a man who had been sitting there for some time and had not particularly benefited from it. He looked up when she entered. They regarded each other for a moment. Sarah considered retreating. She dismissed the thought. She had as much right to the library as he did. He had said so himself, explicitly, when he gave her the run of the household. She walked to the opposite chair, sat down, and opened the book she had brought with her. The silence stretched. It was not entirely comfortable, but it was not hostile either. It was the silence of two people who did not know what to do with each other, and were both, in their separate ways, too stubborn to leave. Jasper spoke first. The question was abrupt, almost accusatory. Why had she agreed so easily? Most women, he said, would have found the terms difficult, would have argued, or wept, or attempted negotiation. Sarah looked up from her book. She considered the question as it deserved to be considered. Then she told him the truth, because she was tired of calculating what to withhold. She said that the terms he had offered were the most generous she had received in years, that she had come from a house where she was not wanted, and that a house where she was simply not noticed was, by comparison, an improvement she had not dared hope for. She watched his face while she said it. Something moved there, not pity. She didn't want pity, and she didn't think he was capable of it anyway, but something. A shift in the set of his jaw. A very brief stillness that was different from his usual stillness. He said nothing. He looked back at the fire, but he did not leave. They sat in the library for nearly 2 hours. No significant conversation was exchanged after that initial exchange. He read, or pretended to. She read, and did not pretend. The fire burned lower, and she rose to add another log, and he watched her do it with an expression she could not decipher. When she finally rose to leave, she said goodnight. He returned it. The word was brief and plain, and entirely without warmth, but it was there. The next morning at breakfast, he was already seated when she arrived. He had never been there before. He had always eaten earlier, or in his study, or not at all, as far as she could tell. He looked up when she entered. He said good morning. Then he returned to his correspondence. Every servant in the room noticed. Sarah was quite certain none of them looked at anything else for the remainder of the meal. The wedding night had been, by mutual and unspoken agreement, delayed. Jasper had not raised the matter. Sarah had not raised it. The contract required an heir. Eventually, the word eventually had been doing a great deal of work between them, and neither had moved to define it more precisely. It was Dottie who let it slip, without meaning to, on a Thursday evening while helping Sarah dress for dinner, that the Duke had left instructions with Mrs. Wolfe about the adjoining chamber, that certain preparations had been made. Sarah sat very still while Dottie finished with her buttons. That evening, after dinner, a meal at which Jasper had been present, which was becoming, very slowly, less unusual, Sarah went to her chambers. She dismissed Dottie gently, thanked her, closed the door. She stood for a moment in the center of the room. The fire was built high, and several candles burned on the mantel and the side table, and the room was warmer and softer than it usually was, which told her that Mrs. Wolfe had been given specific instructions she had followed without commentary. Sarah reached up and untied the hood. It fell away slowly. She felt the cool air of the room against her face, against her forehead, her cheekbones, the bridge of her nose. She felt the weight lift from her shoulders in a way that was not entirely about the garment. She did not look in the mirror. She sat on the edge of the chair near the fire, and she waited. When the knock came, she said, "Come in." Jasper Knowles opened the door and stepped inside, and stopped. The change in him was immediate and complete. It was not dramatic. He did not stagger, did not make a sound, did not do any of the things that a lesser man might have done in that moment. But he stopped moving entirely, and the expression on his face, that carefully managed blankness he wore like armor, cracked. Not shattered, just cracked, a fault line appearing in stone. He looked at her for a long time without speaking. What he saw was this: a young woman with warm auburn hair that caught the firelight in a way the hood had never allowed, with a face that was neither fashionable nor conventional, but was striking in a way that was entirely its own high cheekbones, a mouth that held its emotions too carefully, dark eyes that were watching him right back with an expression that was steady and a little sad, and completely without pretense. She was not plain. She was so far from plain that the word felt faintly absurd. Something moved behind his eyes, something fast and dark, and his jaw tightened. And Sarah knew, watching him, exactly what was happening. She had seen that look before, in a different form. The look of a man who believed he had been deceived. She spoke before he could. She did not raise her voice. She said that she understood what he was thinking, and that she wanted him to know she had not deceived him, that she was not responsible for how she had been presented, that the hood, the gown, the arrangement of her appearance at Whitmore Hall had been her stepmother's design from beginning to end, and she had had no more choice in it than she had had in coming to the assembly at all. He listened. His jaw remained tight. The storm behind his eyes did not fully clear, but Sarah did not look away, and she did not apologize, because she had nothing to apologize for, and something in the steadiness of that, the simple, quiet fact of a woman who would not collapse under the weight of his suspicion, seemed to reach him in a place his anger could not quite follow. The silence between them lasted long enough to be uncomfortable, and then lasted a little longer. Then he turned, and he left, and the door closed behind him with a sound that was not quite a slam, and not quite gentle either. Sarah sat by the fire for a long time afterward. She could hear, faintly, through the wall that adjoined his chamber, the sound of footsteps, slow, deliberate, back and forth. A man who had planned to sleep and was finding, to his considerable inconvenience, that he could not. She thought about that. And she thought about the crack in his expression. And she thought about a manor full of closed rooms and untended gardens, and she held all of it quietly in her chest, like something fragile and not yet named. If you're still here after all that, it shows you find the story interesting. If so, then do me this one favor. Hit subscribe on Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles. Also, drop a comment telling me what you think about the story so far. Your thoughts are always welcome here, and your presence here means more than you know. The best is still ahead. Welcome to the family. In the days that followed the wedding night, Jasper Knowles became a ghost in his own house. He was present in the technical sense. His boots were heard on the stairs before dawn. His study lamp burned well past midnight. His place was set at the dinner table, whether he appeared to fill it or not. But the quality of his presence had changed. Where before he had been simply absent, occupied by the business of running an estate and the habit of solitude, he was now absent in a way that had direction to it. He was absent from her, specifically, deliberately, with the kind of consistency that told Sarah it was not carelessness, but decision. She understood it for what it was. A man who had not expected what he saw when she removed that hood was now doing what men like him always did. When something surprised them, he was retreating to where the ground felt solid, pulling distance around himself like armor, and pretending that what had cracked in his expression that evening had not cracked at all. Sarah found, to her own mild surprise, that she did not find this frightening. She found it almost endearing, in the way that very large and very proud things were endearing when caught in a moment of vulnerability they could not entirely conceal. She said nothing about it. She did not pursue him. She simply went about the work of the manor and let him have his distance, because she understood, better than most, the particular comfort of walls. And there was, as it turned out, a great deal of work to go about. Ashford Manor had been running for 2 years on the momentum of its previous routines and the grim efficiency of Thorne, who managed the estate accounts with the possessive competence of a man who had decided he was the only person capable of the task. The household accounts, when Sarah finally extracted them through a combination of patient repetition and the quiet, immovable politeness that Thorne had clearly not anticipated from a woman in a rough hood and a drab gown, revealed a picture that was, in the kindest possible reading, untidy. Not dishonest, necessarily, just untidy. Expenditures approved without record. Supply orders placed with the same vendors, regardless of whether better terms were available elsewhere. Small inefficiencies accumulated over years into something that, in aggregate, amounted to a significant sum, leaving the estate without particularly good reason. Sarah said nothing to Thorne. She said nothing to Jasper. She simply began, methodically and without drama, to correct things. She renegotiated the kitchen supply arrangements through Mrs. Wolfe, who turned out to have strong opinions on the matter and had simply never been asked to act on them. She found, in the household records, a gardener who had been on the estate payroll for 18 months, but whom no one had seen, tend a single bed or trim a single hedge. He turned out to be Thorne's nephew, which explained a great deal and settled several questions she had not yet put into words. Dottie watched all of this with barely concealed delight. The staff watched with something more cautious, but it was shifting. Mrs. Wolfe had begun answering Sarah's questions before they were fully asked. The kitchen girls had stopped going silent when she walked through. Even the footman, who had initially regarded her with the politely blank expressions of people instructed to be respectful but not told why, had begun greeting her in the mornings with something that was almost warmth. Jasper watched all of this from doorways and the heads of staircases and the windows of his study, and he did so with an expression that Sarah, on the two occasions she caught him doing it, could not fully read. It was not the expression he wore when he was working through a problem. It was quieter than that, more still. She thought, once, that it might be the expression of a man watching something grow in soil he had assumed was barren, and not yet knowing what to do with that information. She filed the thought away and said nothing. It was 3 weeks after the wedding night when she asked about the archive. The estate's historical records were kept in a room on the lower ground floor, stone-walled, dry, lined with shelves of leather-bound ledgers and document boxes going back generations. Sarah had been working through the financial records for the current year, but wanted to understand the longer patterns of the estate's income and expenditure. She made the request to Jasper directly, catching him in the corridor outside his study on a Tuesday morning when he had not quite managed to be elsewhere in time. He looked at her for a moment with that quality of assessment she had learned to read as his version of consideration. Then he said yes, and gave instructions to Thorne, whose expression upon receiving them was a small portrait of suppressed displeasure, that the archive was to be made available to the Duchess at her request. The room was cold and smelled of age, and Sarah liked it immediately. She spent several afternoons there over the following week, working through ledgers methodically. The patterns she found were, for the most part, exactly what she had expected. The estate's income was solid, its history manageable, its problems explicable by 2 years of reduced attention, and Thorne's particular style of management. She found the letters on a Thursday afternoon, in the space between two ledger boxes on the second shelf from the bottom, near the back of the room where the lamplight barely reached. They were tied with a length of faded ribbon, perhaps a dozen of them, the handwriting on the outer envelope faded but legible. They were addressed to a woman named Corinna, her mother's given name, a name Sarah had heard only rarely, mostly in the past tense, mostly spoken by people who wanted her to understand that Corinna had been a problem. Sarah held them for a long time without opening them. She sat on the stone floor with the bundle in her hands and listened to the silence of the archive around her and felt something she could not quite name, a premonition, perhaps, or the particular quality of stillness that preceded things that could not be unknown. She put them inside her journal and took them back to her rooms, and she did not open them that evening, and she told herself she was simply tired. She opened them 4 days later, alone, by firelight, when the house was quiet enough that the silence had weight. The letters were from her father. Not the father she had been told about, the man whose legitimate marriage to a woman of good standing had produced Celia and a title and a reputation, the marriage that had made Sarah's own existence a point of shame and an inconvenient evidence of his character. These letters predated all of that. They were dated years earlier, and they were written in a hand that was careful and ardent, and entirely without the coldness she associated with the sparse memories she carried of him. He had loved her mother. That was the first thing that was clear. He had loved Corinna in the particular, consuming way of young men who have not yet learned to manage themselves, and the letters were full of it: plans, promises, arrangements. An arrangement, specifically. A marriage. Conducted quietly, in a small church in a village 3 counties away, with 2 witnesses whose names Sarah did not recognize, conducted legally, conducted first, before any other marriage, before any other arrangement, before the official union that society recognized and recorded and had used for Sarah's entire life to define her as outside it. Her parents had been married. She read the letters twice. She sat with the fact of it for a long time, turning it over, examining it from each side. Then she found the name that appeared in the final 3 letters, a name mentioned as the man who had been approached about the record, the man who had arranged for the earlier marriage to be, in the language of the letters, set aside, made to disappear, in exchange for considerations that were not specified, but implied to be significant. Lord Callum dressed. Sarah set the letters down very carefully on her knee. Lord Callum dressed. She knew the name. She had heard it twice since arriving at Ashford, once from Dottie, in the context of the previous Duchess's family, and once in a brief, clipped comment from Mrs. Wolfe about visitors the estate no longer received. Lord Drest, the father of the first Duchess of Ashford, the father of the beautiful, celebrated woman whose rooms were still closed in the East Wing, and whose name nobody in this house said without a particular kind of careful nothing in their voice. The same man who had helped bury her mother's marriage. The same man whose daughter had been Jasper Knowles's first wife. Sarah sat by the fire for a very long time. And then she stood, and she gathered the letters, and she went to find her husband. She knocked on the study door at 10:30 in the evening, which she had never done before. There was a pause, and then a short acknowledgement, and she went in. Jasper was at his desk with papers spread across it, and a lamp burning close. He looked up when she entered, and something in her expression made him straighten. She set the letters on the desk in front of him. She told him where she had found them. She told him what they contained. She told him about the marriage, her mother, the name at the end. He listened without interrupting, which she had come to understand was how he listened when something genuinely had his attention. When she finished, he looked down at the letters. He read through several of them with the focused stillness of a man processing something carefully. Then he reached the final letter and stopped, and something happened in his face, a sharpening, a recognition, followed immediately by a particular kind of controlled stillness that was different from his usual blankness. It had heat underneath it. He knew the handwriting. Not her father's, the other hand, the notation in the margin of the final letter, made by someone other than the author. A clerk, or an intermediary, or a man who had been careless enough to annotate a document he assumed would never surface again. Jasper had seen that handwriting before, on documents that had been presented to him years ago as evidence in a legal matter regarding the Ashford estate, documents that had turned out to be false, but by the time their falseness was demonstrable, the damage had already been arranged. He set the letter down. They looked at each other across the desk in the firelight, and Sarah felt, in that moment, the particular quality of a thing that had been kept separate by mutual, unspoken agreement, suddenly becoming shared. It was a strange feeling. It was not comfortable, but it was, in its way, the most honest thing that had passed between them since the night she had taken off the hood. He told her, in the measured, factual way he told everything, what he knew of Lord Callum Drest, what Drest's daughter had done, what the marriage had been, in practice, and what it had cost, the estate's losses, the forged documents, the manner in which it had ended, which he described without flourish and with only the faintest, most contained edge of something that had once been much sharper. Sarah listened, and did not look away, and when he finished, she said simply that it appeared they had more in common than a contract. Something shifted in his expression, not quite a smile. Something adjacent to one. They sat across that desk for another hour, talking carefully about what the letters meant and what could be done with them. It was the longest conversation they had yet had, and when Sarah finally rose to leave, she noticed that he had not once retreated into his usual blankness. He had remained, the entire time, entirely present. She found that she was not entirely sure what to do with that. Word, it turned out, moved faster through certain networks than Sarah had appreciated. She was not certain how Lord Callum Drest learned that the new Duchess of Ashford had been in the estate archive. She had her suspicions, Thorne's face, when she returned that evening with the letters tucked inside her journal, had held a quality of calculation that she had noted and filed away. She could not prove it. But she was not surprised. 2 weeks later, when Mrs. Wolfe appeared at the door of her sitting room on a Wednesday morning to inform her, with the particular tightness around the eyes that was Mrs. Wolfe's version of concern, that a visitor had arrived unannounced. Lord Callum Drest was everything the letters had suggested he would be, and nothing she had been able to fully prepare for. He was a man of perhaps 60, with white hair worn elegantly, a coat that spoke of considerable expenditure, and a face that had arranged itself, over many years, into an expression of benevolent interest that sat over the actual contents of his eyes, the way good plasterwork sat over crumbling stone. He was charming. He was warm. He shook Jasper's hand in the entrance hall with the ease of an old acquaintance, and spoke of the pleasure of calling on the newly established household. Sarah watched from the gallery above, her hands resting on the stone balustrade, and looked at the man who had buried her mother's marriage and sold her mother's life, and felt a cold, clear, entirely unfrightened anger settle in her chest, like ballast. Jasper received him with a courtesy so precise it could have been mistaken, by anyone not paying attention, for genuine hospitality. Sarah, who was paying attention, saw it for what it was, the absolute minimum required by social form, delivered without a degree of warmth to spare. She came downstairs when Jasper sent a footman to request her presence. She sat in the drawing room and drank tea, and answered Lord Drest's pleasant inquiries about how she was finding the estate with answers that were equally pleasant and equally empty. Then Jasper was called away a matter of estate business, his steward appearing at the door with an urgency that Sarah suspected had been arranged in advance by the man sitting across from her. Drest waited until the door had been closed for precisely the right amount of time. Then the pleasant expression shifted not into something cruel, not into something overtly threatening, but into something that was worse than either, in a way. It settled into clarity. The clarity of a man explaining the facts of a situation to someone who has not yet understood them, with the patience of someone who has arranged those facts himself, he told her, in a voice that remained entirely conversational, that letters found in private archives were inherently unreliable documents, that a woman of her background, an acknowledged illegitimate daughter, brought to a marriage assembly in a hood, with no family of standing, willing to speak on her behalf, making claims against a peer of his standing, would find the courts a very difficult environment. That the story such a woman might tell would, in the telling, reveal a great many things about her own origins and circumstances that would make her continued position in this household and in society more broadly rather difficult to sustain. He smiled at her when he finished. It was a genuinely warm smile. That was the most frightening part of it. Sarah looked at him across the tea table and said nothing for a long moment. Then she thanked him for his visit and stood and rang for the footman, and had him shown out with every courtesy that was owed to a guest. She stood in the drawing room alone after he left, and let her hands unclench, slowly, one finger at a time. She was shaken. She would not pretend otherwise, at least not to herself. The threat was not empty. He was correct that she was vulnerable, that her history was precisely the weapon he would use, that courts and society both operated on the currency of reputation, and hers had been arranged, very deliberately, over many years, to be worth nothing. The garden was where she went when she needed air, and it was where Jasper found her. It was dusk, the light going soft and gold between the overgrown hedges, and she was standing near what had once been a rose bed, her arms folded, her gaze on the middle distance. He came to stand beside her. He did not ask immediately. He simply stood there in the way she had come to recognize, present, and waiting, and prepared to wait as long as was needed. She told him everything, exactly as Drest had said it, in the same conversational tone, because she had found that reporting cruelty accurately was more effective than editorializing it. She watched Jasper's jaw tighten, degree by degree, as she spoke. She watched the controlled fury move through him like weather through a room contained, but unmistakably there. When she finished, the garden was quiet around them. Then he reached over and took her hand. It was not a dramatic gesture. It was not accompanied by words, immediately, or by any particular expression beyond the one he already wore. It was simply his hand around hers, warm, steady, certain, and he held it the way a man held something he was not planning to release. "She would not face this alone," he said. "Whatever came next, whatever Drest attempted, she would not face it without him beside her." Sarah looked down at their joined hands and then up at him, and she did not say the thing that rose in her throat, because it was too early and she was too careful for that. But she held his hand back, and the garden went on being quiet around them, and it was enough. The Aldermore Ball was the event of the season, in the way that certain things are simply understood to be true without requiring argument. Every family of standing attended, every alliance was observed, every scandal was either confirmed or denied by who arrived, with whom, and where they stood, and what they chose to say or not say in the hearing of particular people. Jasper had attended every year since inheriting the title, always alone, always leaving early, always prompting the same observation from the same cluster of well-meaning acquaintances about the pity of a man with such an estate not having a proper domestic arrangement. This year would, he had initially assumed, be similar. He would attend, conduct the necessary social business, and return to Ashford before anything interesting could happen. He had not, initially, planned to bring Sarah. He told her, 3 days before the ball, that he would be attending. He said it in the tone he used for household business, factual, brief, slightly preoccupied. Sarah said nothing for a moment. Then she asked, very calmly, whether she would be accompanying him. He looked at her. She looked at him. The question was not quite as simple as it sounded, and both of them understood that. On the evening of the ball, the carriage that arrived at Aldermore Park carried both of them. Sarah had asked Dottie, quietly, to see what could be arranged from the manor's existing resources. What Dottie had arranged was, as it turned out, considerable. The gown was one that had been in the manor's stores, a deep, clear blue that had been set aside for some occasion that had never come, altered to fit in 2 days of work that left Dottie exhausted and quietly proud. Her hair was down, or mostly down, arranged with the kind of deliberate simplicity that was, in the right light, more striking than elaborate curls. No hood, no veil, nothing between her face and whatever the room chose to make of it. Jasper said nothing when he saw her in the entrance hall. He offered his arm. They walked into Aldermore together, and the room reacted. It was not the explosion of sound that the marriage assembly had produced. It was the inverse, a gradual, comprehensive quiet that moved outward from their entrance like a stone dropped into still water. Faces turned. Fans paused mid-flutter. Conversations trailed off mid-sentence. The ruthless Duke of Ashford, who had attended this event alone for 2 years, had arrived with a woman on his arm, and the woman was unveiled, and the woman was the room adjusted and readjusted, calculating and recalculating, quite remarkably beautiful. Sarah kept her chin level and her hand light on his arm, and looked at the room with the expression she had perfected over many years of being looked at unkindly. Not defiance, not apology, simply presence. Drest was there. She found him within the first minutes, as she had known she would, standing near the far end of the room with two other gentlemen, his pleasant expression already in place, already watching them with the particular quality of attention that was not attention, but surveillance. He moved toward them eventually, as she had known he would. He was too practiced to do it immediately. He let half an hour pass first, let the social circulation of the room provide him with a natural path across it, until he arrived at their vicinity with the ease of coincidence rather than intention. He was charming. He expressed delight at seeing the Duke and, particularly, the Duchess. And the slight emphasis on the word Duchess was so slight that only someone who had sat across from him in a drawing room and heard the threat beneath the pleasantness would have caught it. Then he turned to the two men at his side and began, in the conversational way of someone raising an interesting social curiosity, to wonder aloud about the circumstances of the Ashford marriage, the unusual manner in which the match had been made. The questions not his own, he was quick to note, but questions that circulated, as questions did about the background of the new Duchess, her origins, the manner of her presentation at the assembly, whether a woman of such unclear standing could properly be said to hold the title. It was expertly done. It was the kind of social destruction that left no fingerprints. Jasper stepped forward. He did not raise his voice. He did not need to. When the Duke of Ashford spoke in a certain register, conversations within a substantial radius simply stopped by a kind of collective and involuntary attention. He said, clearly and without any particular expression, that he was glad Lord Drest had raised the matter of the Duchess's origins. He had, in fact, prepared for precisely this occasion. He gestured to a man who had been standing near the wall for the past hour, in the inconspicuous manner of someone who had been instructed to stand inconspicuously until required a magistrate, as it turned out, of the county court, who had been invited specifically for this purpose. Jasper presented the letters. He named the church, the date, the witnesses. He named the document that proved the earlier marriage had been legally valid and had been suppressed through falsification. Falsification in a hand that appeared on other documents also in evidence, documents which the magistrate had been provided copies of earlier that week. He named Lord Callum Drest as the man whose handwriting appeared on all of them. The room had the quality of a collective held breath. Drest's pleasant expression did not shatter. It simply stopped working. Beneath it was a man doing rapid calculations and finding all of them insufficient, and the moment that realization crossed his face was brief but entirely visible to everyone watching. Then Jasper turned to Sarah, and the room watched him turn, and in the quality of the turn, the way he moved to face her, the way his attention shifted to her as though everything else in the room had become, momentarily, irrelevant. Something communicated itself to the assembled company before a single word was said. He looked at her in the candlelight of Aldermore's grand hall, with half of England's good society watching, and he said that she was the most honest person he had known, and that it had taken him longer than it should have to understand that honesty in a person was not a quality to be feared, but one to be worthy of. He said that she was his wife and his duchess, and that she had been those things since the day she walked into his house and made it, without trying, into something that deserved the name. The room was very still. Sarah looked at him, this severe and complicated man who had chosen her as a calculation and been undone by her completely, and she felt the warmth of it move through her in a way that had nothing to do with the candles or the crowded room. Drest was escorted from the ball by the magistrate and two men who had come with him, and the quiet that followed his departure was the kind that meant everyone understood what had just happened and was already composing the letter they would write home about it. The legal proceedings took 3 months. They were not pleasant months. There were depositions and counterclaims, and the particular grinding tedium of law, which moved at a pace designed, it seemed, to exhaust everyone involved into submission. Sarah attended every session that required her presence, accompanied by Jasper and by the solicitor he had engaged, who was precise and formidable, and had clearly been chosen specifically for those qualities. At the end of 3 months, the court found in her favor. The prior marriage was confirmed. The Henderson inheritance lands and income that had been tied up in arrangements that had depended on the illegitimacy claim was formally restored to its rightful heir. Sarah sat in the solicitor's office on the day the final document was signed and looked at the pages in front of her and felt very little of what she had expected to feel. Not triumph, exactly. Not even relief, in the simple way she had imagined. Something quieter. The particular feeling of a truth that had always been true finally being called by its name. Viscountess Maren received a letter informing her of the court's findings and the associated implications for her access to the Henderson estate's income. Sarah did not write the letter herself. She did not need to. The facts required no embellishment. She wrote a different letter, a shorter one, to Maren's daughter Celia, the one kind face in that house, the one who had been neither cruel nor empowered to prevent cruelty. She arranged, through the restored Henderson accounts, a provision for Celia that would allow her to live without dependence on her mother. She received a reply that was 3 lines long, and which she read twice and then kept in the drawer of her writing table. The gardens at Ashford Manor had been Sarah's project since the first week she arrived, though she had not announced it as such and had not asked permission. She had simply begun, in small ways, to tend things. A rosebush restaked here, a path re-graveled there. She had spoken to the groundskeeper, a man named Aldous, elderly, who turned out to have very strong views about what the gardens had once been, and a deep, mournful frustration at what they had become, and they had agreed, without much formality, on what might be done and in what order. Over the months of the legal proceedings, while papers were being filed and arguments being made in courtrooms, the gardens at Ashford had been quietly becoming themselves again. By the spring following the ball, the rose beds were blooming. The paths were clean. The hedges had been brought back into the shapes they had been intended to hold, and the kitchen garden that had been reduced to weeds now produced enough to meaningfully supplement what the estate purchased from outside. Jasper had watched all of it happen with the expression she had come to understand, the one that was not quite wonder and not quite anything else she had a precise name for, but which involved a quality of attention that was not the attention he gave to estate business or correspondence. He had asked once how she knew what to do in a garden. She had told him the truth. She did not, particularly. She had simply found someone who did and made sure he had what he needed to do it. Jasper had looked at her for a moment, and then looked at the gardens and said, very quietly, that he had forgotten what they looked like. She had not asked him to clarify whether he meant the gardens or something else. He was different, and had been different since the ball, not dramatically, not in any way that announced itself, but perceptibly. He came to the library in the evenings, and did not always bring work with him. He appeared at dinner with something occasionally approaching punctuality. He asked, sometimes, what she had been doing that day, and listened to the answer with the attention of a man who actually wanted to know. He sought her in rooms. It was the small things she noticed first, the way his gaze went to her position in a room before it went anywhere else. The way, in company, his attention returned to her at regular intervals like something calibrated. She did not remark on it. She simply noted it, and kept it carefully, the way she kept all things she did not yet know what to do with. The evening in the library came on an ordinary Tuesday in late spring, not long after the final legal documents had been received and filed, and the matter, in its official form, had concluded. She was reading. He had been present for perhaps an hour, and they had talked about several things in the comfortable, unremarkable way of people who had learned each other's rhythms, and then had been quiet together in the way that required no management. He set his book down. She heard it and looked up. He was looking at her with the particular quality of a man who had reached a decision after a long time of deliberating, and who found, now that the deliberation was finished, that the decision felt simpler than it had seemed from inside the deliberating. He said that he loved her. He said it plainly, without preamble, in the same register he used for facts he was entirely certain of. He said that he had understood this for some time and had been determining how to say it, and had eventually concluded that the direct approach was the only honest one, and that she deserved honesty above everything else. Sarah set her own book down. She had known. She had known in the way she had come to know many things about this man, not from what he said, but from the accumulated evidence of how he moved through the world when she was in it. She had known it, and had been waiting, without pressure, for him to arrive at it himself. She looked at him across the firelit room, this severe, careful, quietly extraordinary man who had chosen her as an act of self-protection, and had been transformed instead, and she felt, for the first time in her memory, entirely visible, not observed, not assessed, seen. She told him that she loved him too. She said it in the same plain, certain way, because she had learned from him that directness was its own form of tenderness. The library was quiet around them. The fire was warm. The garden was in full color when they stood in it together on an evening in early summer roses along the south wall, the kitchen garden in ordered rows beyond the hedge, Aldous's pride and taciturn satisfaction evident in every tended inch of it. Sarah stood in the middle of the path she had had re-graveled in the autumn, and Jasper stood beside her, and neither of them was looking at the garden exactly, but at what the garden had become from what it had been. Two people who had arrived at each other by the worst possible method. A woman sold as worthless, a man determined to feel nothing. A hood, a rope, a candlelit hall full of people who had watched and whispered and understood nothing of what they were watching. They had chosen each other badly, for the wrong reasons, in the wrong season, with every advantage arranged against them. And they had found, in the quietest and most unheroic way, that it had not mattered. That love was not prevented by bad conditions, or cold arrangements, or walls built carefully over years to keep it out. That it arrived, if it was real, through whatever gaps were left through late evenings in a library, through honesty given when nothing required it, through a woman who tended things back to life and a man who had forgotten, until he watched her do it, that things could be tended. Sarah looked at the roses and thought about her mother, whose name was finally spoken correctly, whose marriage was finally recorded in the right column of the right document, whose daughter was finally where she was supposed to be. Jasper looked at the garden and thought, as he had been thinking with increasing frequency, that he could not remember what the estate had felt like before she was in it, and that this was entirely her fault, and that he was not remotely interested in her correcting it. The evening light moved across the roses. The garden was very still. They were standing in it together. And that, for now, was the whole of the story, and it was enough. And that is where we leave them. In the garden she brought back to life, with the truth finally spoken and the past finally buried where it belongs. If this story moved you even a little, if you found yourself rooting for Sarah in that candlelit hall, if you held your breath at that ball, if you smiled at that library scene, then you already know that this channel is your kind of place. Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles exists for people who believe that the forgotten ones deserve the most extraordinary endings, that the woman in the rough hood is the one the story was always about, that the man who built the tallest walls has the most to offer when they finally come down. If that is you, then hit that subscribe button right now. Do not scroll past it. The next story is coming, and you do not want to be the person who missed it because they forgot to subscribe. Drop a comment below. Tell me where you are watching from. Tell me which moment got you. Tell me if you cried, because it is completely acceptable if you did. I always read your comments, and they mean more than you know. Like this video, share it with someone who needs a good story today, and hit that notification bell so you are always the first to know. The drama, the secrets, the love that nobody saw coming, it is all waiting for you here. Welcome to the family. We are glad you stayed.